Coming up, a Christian couple in Africa trying to bring healing and hope to what the United Nations has called the worst place on earth to be a woman. And better conditions for immigrant farm workers in Florida, thanks in part to religious organizations.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. At the annual National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, President Obama said his faith plays a large role in his approach to public policy, including the economy. He quoted scripture to explain why he supports eliminating some tax breaks for the wealthy.
I actually think that's going to make economic sense, but for me as a Christian, it also coincides with Jesus' teaching that for unto whom much is given, much shall be required.
The president pointed out that Islam and Judaism have similar teachings. That same morning in Washington, a group of interfaith clergy associated with the Occupy movement held what they called the People's Prayer Breakfast. They said their event was open to everyone, not just the rich and powerful, and they prayed for an end to economic inequality. Religious opposition continued this week to the Obama administration's recent decision to require all health insurance policies to cover contraception. Houses of worship are exempt from the requirement, but several faith-based groups argued that religiously affiliated organizations, like charities and hospitals, should be exempt as well. Criticism has been particularly strong from the U.S. Catholic bishops, many of whom wrote letters that were read at Catholic churches around the country. In a particularly stinging letter, the Bishop of Pittsburgh said the Obama administration has told Catholics, quote, "to hell with you." The contraception controversy also became an issue in the ongoing GOP presidential primaries. At recent campaign stops, Newt Gingrich accused President Obama of waging, quote, "a war on religion," especially against the Catholic Church. As for the Catholic vote, in last week's Florida primary, Mitt Romney, who is Mormon, got 56%, while Gingrich got 30% of his fellow Catholics. Evangelicals in that race divided their votes almost evenly between Gingrich and Romney. Rick Santorum picked up 19% of their votes, and Ron Paul, 4%. Meanwhile, Jewish groups are spearheading an effort to persuade the Obama administration to take stronger action to head off an impending humanitarian disaster in Sudan's border region. American Jewish World Service and the Jewish Council for Public Affairs said the Sudanese government must allow food aid for hundreds of thousands of people facing starvation in the region between Sudan and the one-year-old state of South Sudan. Some 400,000 people have been displaced in ongoing border conflicts. We have a special report now on a Christian couple in Congo trying to offset some of the inhumanity, especially against women, caused by militias fighting for the past 20 years over their country's vast mineral wealth. It's estimated the violence has killed 5 million people. Fred DeSam Lazaro reports.
There are few images of war's destruction in the eastern Congolese city of Goma. Little was built in the first place. For two decades, regional militias have clashed over the minerals here. UN troops have brought some order, but their reach and mandate are limited. So is the Congolese army's efforts to assert control.
A series of peace agreements and two democratic elections have brought some stability here, although very little development. There's still virtually no paved road in this whole country. What's continued unabated is an epidemic of sexual violence. The United Nations says the Democratic Republic of Congo is the worst place on earth to be a woman.
One place where you get an idea of what that means is a refuge called Heal Africa. Women work to shake off unspeakable atrocities they have faced. The trauma has left most with injuries that render them incontinent. This woman wears a mask to conceal her maiming at the hands of militiamen who raided her home one night about a year ago.
My older daughter escaped from them. They told me to go get her, and I said, "She'd escaped from you. How could I ever catch her?" Since I wouldn't give them my daughter, they hit me in the head with a machete. And after I fell down, they used that same machete to cut off my lips.
A volunteer health worker brought her to Heal Africa. It's the only specialty care hospital in all of eastern Congo. It was started 12 years ago by British-born Lynn Lucy and her Congolese husband, devout Christians who'd served the region for years before that as medical missionaries.
Well, my husband was an orthopedic surgeon. He finished in Belgium in 84. And to this day, he's still the only one, the only orthopedic surgeon in the east of the country.
Dr. Joe Lucy has performed thousands of surgical operations, fixing everything from club feet and cleft palates to fistulas, the vaginal, sometimes rectal tearing that comes from rape trauma or obstructed labor. Heal Africa has trained nearly 30 young Congolese doctors, paying for their education elsewhere in Africa. Its bare-bones emergency and intensive care are the only such services in a region of 8 million people, supported by various private and international government grants. 700 children with HIV get life-saving antiretroviral drugs here. But Dr. Lucy says all this is just one part of a much larger idea.
When you serve a human, I don't see you here like a human. I see you like an image of God. So to do that, you have to be holistic. You have to be total. You have to know what about the spirit, about the flesh, about the soul. Here, people are lacking everything. They don't have food, absolute poverty. They are exploited. They are perishing because of the lack of knowledge. They are perishing because of the lack of justice. So me and my wife said, okay, how do you do a holistic system?
HEAL is an acronym. It stands for Health, Education, Action in the Community, and Leadership Development. And all of those are components of a healthy society.
For many patients who come initially for medical care, healing is a years-long process of rebuilding a life. This shelter serves women whose fistulas have not healed, about a quarter of such cases.
It is very different here from back in the village. People were laughing at me. She's smelly. She was raped. Here people know I am a complete person.
Women are taught to sew, make baskets, and raise small animals, and they are allowed to dream.
I want to have a little shop, and I will make bread and sit there with my sewing machine, and people will bring me things to sew. I will make baskets. If I can have a little house, that would be very nice.
For now, for practical purposes, such dreams are pure fantasy, thanks to lingering health problems and also militiamen who continue to raid villages with impunity. Annunciata frequently sees the men who maimed her, but she reacted viscerally to a suggestion she might report them to the police.
I'm terrified. They would kill me. Only God can punish them for what they did.
But Heal Africa has begun working to bring a more immediate justice for victims of rape. In partnership with the American Bar Association, local lawyers work to apprehend suspects and put them through the legal system here. It is flawed and corrupt, but Lynn Lucy says only when Congolese begin to buy into it will it begin to work for them.
I would always encourage our legal aid to work 10 times more on the issue of bringing the community in line with the law so that they appreciate what the law is trying to do and that they agree with it. And then there's social pressure, there's a desire within the community
for zero tolerance of sexual violence, of any sort of violence.
That's what brought this 15-year-old girl and her father to the legal clinic to bring charges against a young man who raped her while she went to collect water for the family.
I want him not only to be put in prison, but also to pay for the damages he caused. Last year, I turned 75 years old. When we were growing up, we never saw this kind of behavior. When you liked a girl, we would get married. I'm really astonished. I'm not sure what's going on, how they can take little girls and assault them.
Lynn Lucy thinks it's a consequence of fighting that has raged for two decades in eastern Congo, destroying any sense of community.
You have seen your village destroyed. You've seen your people killed. And you're a young man with no future. I mean, you have every reason to fight, have every reason to go off and join the militias. There are also those militias that will kidnap children and take them into their armies just to reinforce their ranks. Children are extremely good soldiers in that they have no fear and they have no conscience.
Where does one begin to repair this? The Lucys say they've worked to tap the enduring faith of most Congolese.
Here is a mandate to care that's in the Muslim community, that's in the Christian community, and it's present in every single locality in Congo. You could say that probably 95% of Congolese will go to a place of worship once a month at least. So this is an amazing power within the community. And if we knew how to mobilize people correctly around their mandate to care, then you can make a big impact on a social problem.
Heal Africa has gathered religious leaders and other elders into so-called Nehemiah committees. These gatherings address sources of violence early on, mediating local business disputes or competing land claims before they escalate. Lynn Lucy says it's a start.
I have no illusions that we're dealing with the major issues that are pulling Congo apart. I don't think Heal Africa is going to empty the ocean. But we can take out a bucketful here and a bucketful there. There is so much evil and so much cruelty, so much selfishness, and it is like darkness. But if we can bring in some light, the darkness will not overcome the light. And that's where faith is. We believe that.
For her work, Lucy was awarded the 2011 Opus Prize, a $1 million award given by the Minnesota-based Opus Foundation to a faith-driven social entrepreneur. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam Lazaro in Goma, Democratic Republic of Congo.
Imagine living in a country in which militias kidnap children because they're extremely good soldiers who have no fear and no conscience. There's a debate over whether the Nobel Peace Prize is being awarded to the wrong people. In Oslo, Norway, where the prize is given out, a prominent peace activist says the award has been going to human rights campaigners and environmentalists in violation of the intentions of Alfred Nobel, the inventor of dynamite. In 1895, he wrote in his will that the prize should go to, quote, the person who shall have done the most or the best work for fraternity between nations. The Norwegian critic contends that the last qualified person to get the Peace Prize was then UN Secretary General Kofi Annan in 2001. President Obama got the prize in 2009. For decades, religious organizations such as the National Council of Churches, the Catholic Bishops, and others have been working with labor organizers to try to improve conditions for farm workers. And there's been some success, most recently in the tomato fields of South Florida, where immigrants harvest nearly all the winter tomatoes this country grows. Our report is from Saul Gonzalez in Immokalee, Florida.
Florida may be better known for its oranges, but it's tomatoes that rule in the farm fields surrounding the small town of Immokalee. In fact, during the winter months, nearly all of America's domestically grown tomatoes, still green when they're picked, come from this part of South Florida. And it's a large and poor immigrant workforce that's essential in getting that crop from plant to plate.
Tomato harvesting is still very much by-hand work. I mean, there's no machine that exists.
That is correct, yes.
Steve McCann is harvesting manager for Pacific Tomato Growers, a major producer in Florida.
The production volume from here is somewhere around 12 to 1,400 boxes per acre, and we pack 25-pound boxes is what we're averaging.
So it's industrial-scale
industrial-scale, correct.
However, Florida's tomato industry is a business that's long been accused of exploiting its workforce through overwork, underpay, and mistreatment. That's turned these tomato fields into the front lines of a high-profile national campaign to improve the lives of farm workers.
People who work in agriculture are among the least paid, least protected workers in the whole country.
This is their standards of engagement. Oh. Mm.
Jordan Buckley and his colleagues are with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, or CIW, and the Interfaith Action Network, which works with faith groups to help farm workers.
For people of faith, this is, for us, this is a moral issue. You know, how the people who pick our food are treated.
Now, to understand the plight of farm workers, you have to know something about their place in America's industrial food economy.
They're some of the poorest workers here in our country, and yet not for lack of hard work. It's not some, dearth of industriousness. And in fact, the reason is because the increasing consolidation of purchasing among retailers. So where you have the fast food and food service and supermarkets squeezing their suppliers and demanding ever cheaper costs for their tomatoes, that's resulted in growers squeezing their farm workers. And that's why farm workers haven't seen a real wage increase in upwards of three decades.
Florida's tomato workers are usually paid by how much they pick, traditionally getting about 45 to 50 cents for every 32-pound bucket they fill. That means to make a day's minimum wage, each worker has to pick 2.5 tons of tomatoes a day. What does that kind of work mean for the daily lives of farm workers and their families? 28-year-old Darinel Salas struggles to support his wife and two girls on what he makes in the fields. Because four other farm workers live in the same dilapidated trailer, his whole family shares one small room.
It's because of the situation at work that we live like this. Our pay just doesn't last and allow us to live in a better way.
Immokalee is a town full of young men from Mexico, Central America, and Haiti. Many undocumented who have come here to scratch out a better life for themselves by harvesting Florida's tomato crops. Some of them end up victims of the industry's worst abuses, including incidents of modern-day slavery.
There have also now been 9 federally prosecuted slavery operations in just the last 14 years here in Florida agriculture.
Slavery?
Yeah, literal slavery. Right here on 3rd and Boston, if we go down 4 blocks, that was the site of where workers were locked in the back of a cargo truck, literally shackled. And we saw bruises on their wrists from where they had been literally restrained by their employers.
Yet despite the dangers and low pay, farmhands are eager to work. To see how eager, you've got to get up very early.
Every morning in the pre-dawn hours, this parking lot in downtown Immokalee becomes a giant open-air labor market. Hundreds of farm workers come here looking to make contact with labor bosses. If they're lucky, they'll be picked for another hard day of work in the tomato fields.
The men and women selected are the ones boarding buses that take them directly to the fields. It's in this parking lot that we met Auralia Hinojosa, who's worked in Immokalee's tomato fields for nearly 30 years.
Americans really like their vegetables and fruits. And who is going to pick it? The people born in this country have better kinds of work, and they're not going to go to the fields.
But things are slowly starting to get better for Florida's tomato field workers. Last year, after more than a decade of patient organizing work, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers reached a landmark agreement with growers and corporate tomato buyers, like McDonald's and Burger King. The agreement gives farm workers a penny more for every pound of tomatoes they pick. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but that 1 cent increase translates into an additional 32 cents for every bucket picked by workers. That, in turn, will boost each farmhand's pay by about $5,000 a year.
We're basically on the threshold of entering into this new industry, of having rights protected and there being this consensus among buyers that we demand humane labor conditions in our supply chain.
The agreement has also made some in Florida's powerful tomato industry question their past actions and attitudes.
Historically, it has not been the poster child for good behavior and good treatment of its workers.
That's... You admit to that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sarah Goldberger is a spokesperson for Pacific Tomato Growers. She says the agreement between workers and the tomato industry has replaced tension with cooperation.
It has been so non-adversarial. It's a pleasure, quite honestly.
That's a big change.
Yes.
Other changes in the fields, like this one owned by Pacific Tomato, include greater access to drinking water and more rest periods, regular bathroom breaks, and a zero tolerance for verbal abuse and sexual harassment by field bosses. Now that the coalition of Immokalee workers and its allies have an agreement, they're spreading the word about it.
Un saludo para toda la gente rock and rollera del área de Immokalee.
The small community radio station they run in Immokalee regularly tells workers listening about their rights, pay, and future organizing plans.
La campaña para mejorar las condiciones de trabajo y los sueldos para los trabajadores en el estado de la Florida.
Worker advocate and former field hand Lucas Benitez met us at the early morning labor gathering to talk about how important these changes are to the men and women who pick America's tomato crop.
Y es lo que queremos, que sea un trabajo digno.
That's what we want. Work with dignity, where every worker, every person who goes to the fields, feels pride in being part of the agricultural industry that is putting food on millions of tables every day, and that the worker is getting paid enough to put food on the table of his own home.
However, the coalition of Immokalee workers and its allies in religious and faith groups say they have much work left to do.
This one right here is to public supermarkets.
That includes a new national campaign focused on supermarket chains, which have declined to participate in the penny per pound pay agreement.
There's three principal sectors of tomato retail: fast food, food service, and supermarkets. So now the leaders of the fast food industry are on board. The leaders of the food service industry are on board. All that remains are the supermarkets.
We thank you for this day and the opportunity we have to worship. What a gift that is.
To keep pressure on the stores and to make sure gains are protected, farm workers regularly reach out to religious leaders and congregations.
And so I'm joined by Darinel.
This morning, Jordan and workers from Immokalee, including Darinel Salas, are addressing a Presbyterian church in Naples, Florida. These speaking engagements are part of a sustained campaign to get people of faith thinking about fairness and justice when they sit down to eat. Brigetta Genther of Interfaith Action has been working in Immokalee for 8 years on behalf of workers.
You know, many times when we say grace, we're grateful for the food on our plates. But where did that food travel? Who picked it? How did it get to us? And that's something that we don't often think about, but I think that as people of faith, we are called to think about the connections between us and those who toil in the fields day in and day out to put food on our plates.
For the men and women who pick Florida's tomatoes, their most important harvest has been some measure of justice and respect. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Saul Gonzalez in Immokalee, Florida.
In other news, Cardinal Anthony Bevilacqua, the former Archbishop of Philadelphia, died this week. He was 88 and suffered from dementia and cancer. Bevilacqua led the Philadelphia Archdiocese from 1988 to 2003. His death comes amid a high-profile sex abuse case there involving two priests and a church official who served under him. On our calendar this weekend, Muslims celebrate Maulid an-Nabi, marking the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad. And for Jews, Wednesday is Tu B'Shvat, the new year for trees. It's become a special day for efforts to protect the environment. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, find us on YouTube, watch us anytime, anywhere on smartphones. There's also much more on our website. You can comment on all our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, 11-year-old Jackie Ivanko performs at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be more. PBS.